Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to kick things off because it's vacation time in the NFL with a discussion on participation trophies. And then Jenny and Connor will be in for the news. And as always, we'll wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome back in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We're going to start with a story this week. Jenny and Connor are here. Brandon, our producer's in. And since this is a slow time in the NFL calendar, I figure I'd start with story time here. You guys all right with that?
I sure. love stories.
All right, so let's start with story time. So on Sunday, Saturday was my kid's last T-ball game. And on Sunday, now my son is, I have two sons. One's four and the other one's two. And as anybody's got two boys knows, they kind of can get after each other a little bit. And so on Sunday, my two-year-old stole my four-year-old's T-ball trophy.
Classic younger sibling move.
And then wound up dropping it. It broke in half, right? Now, the four-year-old didn't seem too upset, but the two-year-old, this was actually on Monday, so the two-year-old, or so the four-year-old didn't seem all that upset. Me and my wife pick up the pieces. It's like a clean break, two pieces. And so we go and get some glue. And we got it on the plate. We got some glue on the plate. And I just say to my wife, watch this. And so I take a picture of it, and I put it up on Instagram. And I've told some of these jokes on Instagram before. And I said, and I'm going to have to pull it up so I get it right. Right, guys? Like, I got to be accurate on this one, I think. So I'm going to pull it up right here. I'm going to go to my Instagram app. I know this is great podcasting, that I'm so prepared that I didn't have this ready to go.
I'm zoning out, so just let me know when to hop back in.
I will. So I basically say, where is it? All right. You know what? I can go to my Twitter comments, and it'll be right there for me. So basically, I tweeted out, found out my kid got a participation trophy. Had to be done. Hashtag play like a champion. Hashtag father of the year. And so I Instagrammed that out. A broken participation trophy. Now, this is a four-year-old, mind you. A four-year-old's T-ball trophy. This is my kid's first trophy. Breaks in half. I Instagrammed that out. And there's, when you go to Instagram, you guys, Jenny, you know this, you're on Instagram. You're an Instagram expert,
I'm the
right?
sleuth, yeah.
Right, so you know how like it tells you, like, you can also like simul post it
share
on
it to other
Facebook
media.
Or Twitter. Yeah.
Right.
So I'm just like, yeah, you know, I kind of did it to see what would happen. So, you know, I hit the thing on Twitter and it posts to Twitter too. And all hell broke loose. And according to a lot of people now, I think like Department of Child Services should come and seize my son and I'm a horrible person. And, you know, I've been told now that I'm conservative, right? Like I'm conservative, I'm a Trumper. So I learned all these things about myself when I was telling this joke, and I just wanted to clear that up for everybody. The one thing I take away from it is you can't fix stupid. I mean, I can do a lot of things. I can't fix stupid. Like, this was clearly a joke. Hashtag play like a champion. Hashtag father of the year. I did not break my four-year-old's T-ball trophy, and I was just amazed, and I guess this is just a human experiment when you do this sort of thing. I was amazed by how many people just didn't understand what I was doing and jumped all over it. And I think there were actually some thought pieces written on it and everything else. I want my kid to have his trophy. Like, I'm happy he had a good T-ball season. He wasn't that upset about it breaking. We were putting it back together. The glue didn't work. Update on that. The glue didn't work, so I had to go get some epoxy. And we called the coach and saw if he had any extras. And so within a couple days, we'll have the trophy back up on the mantle in my four-year-old's bedroom. So there you have it.
My takeaway is the rule of thumb from Gary Gramling, which is when in doubt, don't tweet.
Yeah.
That is what I
was the Herm Edwards line?
I live my life by that. So. Don't press send.
Don't press send. Okay. All right. So just to clear that up. All right.
So you spent your money. See, if you didn't tweet Albert, you know, you could have avoided this.
I don't know. Like, it was good entertainment, though. It was good entertainment, I think, for everybody, right? Like, people who wanted to get angry got angry. I looked to see if there was going to be some sort of response, which, I mean, look, my wife commented in the Instagram comments, too. Like, we were sort of seeing if there'd be some sort of response, and a lot of people delivered for me.
My question is, you said that when you tweeted it, you wanted to see what happened. but I feel like before you tweeted it, you probably knew what was going to happen, right?
I think the question was going to be, the question was always going to be the intensity of it, right?
Okay.
Like the intensity of it, like I was surprised by the intensity of it. I thought it would fly over a few people's heads, you know, whatever. And like things have flown.
The glue was not all that visible.
To be fair, like things have flown over my head in the past too. So I'm not immune to this, but I just wanted to see, you know, see what happens. And, and you know, the other lesson, of course, is that people who don't like you just don't like you and are probably waiting for certain things, and caught some of those people too.
Having missed a large portion of this controversy, because I'm on a Twitter diet.
How does that work?
Like just maybe like 2 or 3 days in a row where I just won't go on it.
Do you delete it off your phone, like the app off your phone?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I've heard that that's the move, is like deleting it off your phone so you don't have the reflex of going to your phone, right?
Yeah. Did the photo make it clear, or any part of the caption make it clear, that you were really intending to fix it? Or was
there were dabs of glue on the paper plate. Like Jenny said, if you looked closely, you could see it, right? Like, so it was on a paper plate, which, first of all, I mean, like, that's where you put it when you glue it. There was dabs of glue.
I feel like you're making a lot of assumptions.
But I figured the hashtags would be like the giveaway, right? Like dubbing myself Father of the Year and putting Play Like a Champion, like Play Like a Champion hashtag on a, like putting a Play Like a Champion hashtag on a T-ball trophy was probably, you're either joking or you've got a serious problem.
I would say workshop it next time a little bit, maybe bounce it off a few more
people. By the way,
I got
a response from a lot of people loved it. A lot of the feedback I got was very, very positive.
And James Harrison?
That it made their day. Well, not in the James Harrison sort of way.
Here's a question I have, though. The trophy actually says champion. So did he win? Was it more than a participation trophy?
As far as I know, everyone got those, but
okay.
I'm not positive.
They probably don't keep score for four-year-olds.
The kid is four.
Now, while we're talking about childhood accomplishments,
By the way, they may have won the championship. I don't know, because they don't keep scoring.
They don't keep score for four-year-olds, right?
Right.
I just really want to plug myself here. I was at home this weekend in State College, Pennsylvania. Went for a run past the Park Forest neighborhood pool.
Yep.
You know, used to participate in swim team there in the summers. It was kind of like the side fun swim team. You know, we'd do all the other meets and you'd go to your neighborhood pool. And anyways, walked in because there was a meet going on, heard the buzzer system, went to reminisce, looked over at the record board, and guess who still holds a 12 and under 50 yard backstroke record?
That's what I'm talking about.
That's
wow.
Right. Jenny Brentis, 31.34, I think is what my 50 time
meter
was.
Backstroke.
Which is,
that's
I'm
amazing.
Certain, is an extremely many, poor, mediocre time.
How many laps is that?
Two.
Oh,
back,
this is
up and back.
Up and back. Okay.
Up and back.
Okay.
So I think like at 12, you switch from 25 to 50. So.
Gotcha.
So, you know, that was basically the height of my athletic achievement. And
did
it was all downhill
from there.
Did you take
a selfie in front of it or anything?
I did take a photo of it just to show my mom, because she was like, is this, you know. But let me just say that I questioned the bookkeeping, because we also had the medley relay record and our names were listed and the year was listed as 2013. So it's really possible that there is not accurate bookkeeping at the Park Forest pool.
It was the fourth oldest record on the board. That's incredible. That like stands the test of time.
Wow. Okay, Connor. Thank you. I appreciate it. You know, I just
one
really.
One from 1987, B. Quigley. I'm looking at the photo right now.
Brendan Quigley, swam with him.
Legendary boys swimmer from State College. B. Quigs.
You know, listen, I have zero athletic achievements in my life, so I figured the neighborhood
That's
pool would be.
That's a huge achievement.
This was as good a time as any to plug my 50-yard backstroke.
That's pretty good, Jenny. That's pretty good.
Your parents didn't smash the trophy. How about that?
Yeah. You got to keep that one. Well, I applaud that. That's not a participation trophy. That's
right.
A trophy for
That's
winning.
Right. I was 12.
So you get to keep that one, Jenny. All right. We're going to get into the news of the week now. I'll kick it off. News item number one. This week, Todd Gurley's trainer, Travell Gaines, told CBS's Dave Richard, I believe that's their fantasy football guy, that the running back has a arthritic condition in his knee, confirming previous reports of the Rams' star's injury. Gurley's workload was limited during the team's run to Super Bowl 53. You know, there's been all sorts of things floating around out there on him. I think we knew he had a knee problem coming into the NFL, and a lot of teams were aware of this. If you're a Rams fan right now, how worried are you about this?
I think you're reasonably worried because they already committed a long-term contract for him that is not easy to get out of in the very near term, right? And I think knee conditions never get better. And he is such a was such a focal point of the offense, right? When he was healthy. I think coming into the draft, they obviously picked him when he was coming off the ACL tear his final year in college. But I don't think that at that point in time, there was necessarily concern about the arthritis situation. I remember writing about it. I mean, I never heard anything specifically about that. It was just focusing on the fact that, okay, this guy tore his ACL in November. And, you know, I remember the comparisons were saying he was the best runner perhaps to come out since Adrian Peterson. Yep. And Peterson had come back from the ACL. So I don't really think anyone thought that, but every knee is different and every situation is different. So if you have an arthritis situation that's bone on bone and there's really nothing you can do, once the cartilage is gone, you cannot really replace it.
Right. And I think one of the things that came up, and I made some phone calls on this after I saw the report yesterday. There was a, from what I understand, Jenny, you're probably our expert in the room on this sort of stuff. Like, some teams found a degenerative. Now, I don't know if every team found it, but some teams found a degenerative condition in the knee.
Oh, before the draft.
Right, before the draft.
Interesting.
Before the draft. Now, what has come up here is, like, not every single one is the same, right? So, like, we've heard of these before, and we've heard of ones that are bad. Like, Jay Ajayi coming out of Boise State, Miles Jack coming out of UCLA. Those were, like, all right, like, this might be a one contract guy is the way that those guys were looked at, right? What I was told is this wasn't quite as serious, but I think, Jenny, and you can backstop me on this, I think if you have a degenerative problem in your knee or anywhere, then the question is longevity, right?
Yeah, absolutely, because like I said before, cartilage is not something that can be replaced, right? You hear guys having microfracture procedures and you scrape the surface of the bone and that is supposed to trigger some kind of healing. But once you're down that road, it just gets worse and worse, right? So it's never going to be better than it was last year.
Right.
So that's where I think the concerns come in terms of managing his workload and just how many more carries he has. And again, I don't know how bad the condition is at this point, right? I mean, it could be early on in that. But if you're aware of that, you've got to at least manage the workload to some degree, I would think.
That's why all those CEOs, they drink blood, you know, to try to, you know, at least try to stop the slow march of aging, you know? I mean, because you just don't know.
But. I mean, there are stem cells.
Is that true?
There are stem cell like
true? Wait, see, I can't tell. No, I can't tell if Connor's being serious or not. Is that true?
I think there was. I remember reading something about one of these like uber billionaire people that like buys blood.
Well, yeah. Whose blood?
Like human blood?
Like the blood of young people and drinks it. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, you know, we hear platelet-rich plasma therapy, right, where you concentrate the healing juices and inject them somewhere.
That's the treatment in Germany, right?
Where you spin down the blood. Right, no, yeah. You do that here. That's right, okay. That's everywhere, right? Okay. And then there's stem cells. You hear about stem cells overseas because overseas have slightly more lax rules for stem cell lines. But, you know, there is hope that there are stem cell therapies that could replace cartilage. I just don't think we're 100% there yet. Biologics is sort of that's the next frontier in terms of players coming back from injuries. But I think right now, if you look at a guy with a degenerative knee condition and arthritis, it's an acute concern.
I think I'd be a little more worried if I didn't take Darrell Henderson in the third round. I mean, you know, he was a lot of people's favorite running back in the draft, right? And he was a lot of fun to watch at Memphis. I think he can do a lot of the things that Todd Gurley does. Maybe obviously not to that professional of a level, but we've seen what Sean McVay's offense can do with a 28-year-old running back, you know, that was out of the league for half of a season, you know. I think that there just needs to be a general level of that speed and skill there, and I think Henderson definitely fills that void.
Well, and they also they also matched on Malcolm Brown, who's their backup running back, but the fact that they've invested in that much in the position, a third round pick, and then before that going and matching on a restricted free agent, I think tells you to me like you judge these teams by their actions, and it certainly does seem like they approached running back like it was a need, which you wouldn't think you'd have to do when you got a player like Todd Gurley.
Right, and you know, they had said all offseason that the knee was fine, but like you said, if you look at their actions, it sort of indicates otherwise.
Okay, who wants to take news item number two?
I can handle this. Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers was asked by NFL Network's Michael Silver about the dynamic between he and new coach Matt LaFleur, and in particular how the audible system would work. "I don't think you want me to turn off 11 years, Roger told Silver. "There's stuff that not many people in the league can do at the line. That's not a humble brag, that's just a fact. I mean, obviously Tommy can do it." Interesting. He's just calling him Tommy now. "Peyton Manning can do it. Drew Brees can do it. Patrick Mahomes will be able to do it. Ben Roethlisberger has called the 2 minute for years. There are just a few of us who can do it. It's kind of second nature, and that's the icing on the cake, what I can do in this offense." I think that people need to realize, I think Mike Florio did a good job, first of pointing out the fake Southern accent whenever he's trying to like get across a point, Aaron Rodgers, which is a good job by him. But Aaron is so smart that he knows exactly what he's doing by giving this interview, right? Mm-hmm. He's pointing out that I don't like that you're not letting me call have as much freedom at the line, and I got the last guy fired, and I'm going to make a big temper tantrum until you let me do exactly what I want to do here. And then people are going to ask him about it, and he's going to say, "Oh, the media picks up on everything," and then, you know, in that Southern accent, and then we're back to square one, which is, "Oh, Aaron's probably just a good guy, and it was Mike McCarthy's fault," you know?
So you think that there is something here?
Well, if you read the whole piece, right? I mean, the whole story is about this audible at the line thing, and it's Matt LaFleur legitimately asking open-ended questions. Like, "I learned this offense from Kyle Shanahan. The beauty of it is the speed. Quarterbacks don't have to audible because of the way that we set it up. So how do you put in audibles for someone in an offense that is designed not to audible, you know?" And so it's sort of a conceptual question in the story. But I think the fact that like Aaron is so calculated, I mean, this is not just something he would drop out there if it wasn't bothering.
It's fascinating too, Jenny, because like when you look at why Matt LaFleur was hired in Tennessee, it's because of the work he did with Jared Goff, right? What do those two guys have in common? Well, when those guys got to LA, Goff was coming off his first year. When LaFleur got to Tennessee, Mariota was coming off of his third year. Those are young guys. Even Matt Ryan, you know, when all those guys got to Atlanta in 2015, Matt Ryan was younger than this. And I think that, like, on paper, the way that they do it makes sense because, and I've talked to Matt about this, like, the idea is to get the quarterback playing fast, right? Like, one of the things they do, they take the protection calls off the center, off the quarterback's plate and give them to the center. That's one of the reasons why Atlanta signed Alex Mack. It's one of the reasons why Kyle Shanahan brought in Weston Richburg to play center in San Francisco, why Sean McVay brought John Sullivan to play center with the Rams. Like, they do all these things to try to take stuff off the quarterback's plate, right? Like, and they're trying to make everything simple and get them playing fast, like Connor was saying. I think what's so fascinating about this is, like, the advantage that an Aaron Rodgers has, or that a Tom Brady or a Peyton Manning or anybody who's been in the league for that long has, is basically your offensive coordinator is under center, right? Like, you've got a guy who's fully capable of running the full offense without a whole lot of help. And so I think that that's one of the challenges for them, is marrying those two things.
And I think it's normal for there to be this sort of process where you work through these things. And I think, to Connor's point, you hear LaFleur talking about this. Okay, we have an offense that has a lot of motions, and what, you know, when you have a lot of motions before the snap, that doesn't allow you a lot of time remaining on the play clock to get into a different play, right? So just the system itself is not necessarily set up for that. And he likened it a lot to the Shanahan system, which, you know, obviously Matt Ryan, a veteran quarterback, ran, you know, with success under Shanahan in Atlanta. So I think you hear them trying to workshop through it. I think where the concern is probably is that there were subtle little digs from Rodgers, right? And I think that was always the question, bringing in a younger guy like LaFleur, who has never worked with a strong
is
personality.
Aaron walk all over him?
Well, you know, some of the comments about, you know, just almost speaking it, like reminding him, reminding the public or reminding LaFleur that he has all this experience audibling. This is what he does. And then there were other subtle little remarks about LaFleur not getting his jokes, which felt a little bit like, I don't know, why was that necessary? And maybe that's just the sense of humor, right? Maybe that doesn't come through as clearly in writing the same way that it would in person. But I do think it's going to be fascinating. It does not mean they will not figure it out. And I do think it's two smart guys talking it out, saying we do have something that we need to work through and figure out how this is going to work. And it may work beautifully. But I do think it was a smart story by Silver, like asking this fundamental question, like this difference of opinions, right? Like, how are they going to meet in the middle? And that's going to be really interesting to see.
I think what's really interesting too, like, so, like, I remember hearing the story, and I'm sure you guys have heard this story, Tom Brady, when Josh McDaniels went to Denver, texted Bill O'Brien, who was going to replace Josh. And the text was, I want to be coached, right? Like, it's just a very simple, I want to be coached. And I talked to Clyde Christensen this morning for something I'm doing on Jameis Winston, and Peyton Manning came up, and he said the same thing. Like, everybody thinks Peyton doesn't want to be coached. Peyton wants to be coached. He wants to be challenged. Like, that's why he loved Adam Gase, because Adam Gase would give him new information. It's hard to coach these guys because these guys have seen everything. So how do you give these guys new information? I think the question is, does Aaron want to be coached? You know, like, because if you can marry having, like, you know, being that great a player to begin with and having all that experience with getting coaching that's actually constantly giving you new information, then I think that that's where this thing can really be great. And my question is, does Aaron want to be coached? And maybe is this a process of Aaron trying to figure out whether or not the guy can give him? I don't know. I mean, like, but there's just, I think with quarterbacks at this level, I actually think that's why, like, Josh McDaniels would have been an interesting hire for them, because I think it's hard to give a guy like that new information. And the guy also on the flip side has to want to be coached. And I don't know if it's clear if Aaron wants to be coached based on how things went with Mike McCarthy.
I just think we're beyond the point where, you know, we just need to get past the point that, oh, he's just kidding. I mean, Aaron has been doing this for 10 years.
Passive aggressive.
He's been making these passive aggressive comments and then coming back and saying, what are you talking about, for 10 years? I mean, so, you know, at this point, until I'm led to believe otherwise, I am taking this, you know, at face value for what it is, which is kind of like a little knock on the door of LaFleur to say, hey, this is who you're dealing with.
Okay. That will be interesting, very interesting to follow over the next couple of months. Connor, news item number 3.
On Friday, the Texans withdrew their pursuit of Nick Caserio for the vacant GM job, and the Patriots withdrew their tampering charge against Houston on Caserio. The job, it appears, will remain vacant for the time being.
Yeah, and I just had you try. I apologize, Jenny. I think I just had him read to
fine.
Him.
Oh, fine.
I'm all over the place today.
No.
I honestly think that this is, I mean, first of all, I can't, Jack Easterby and Nick Caserio have the same agent, right? Like, how the Texans wouldn't have known about this term in his contract, it just doesn't seem believable. I know what's going to happen now, which is that Bill O'Brien is going to have, I mean, there are a couple things here. First, like, I know what's good, like Bill O'Brien has control for now of the football operation, right? And the top guys, at least on paper right now, are going. The top guys in the scouting department, Matt Bezerjian, who's going to run the pro side, and James Lipfert, who's going to run the college side, those guys are going to report to Bill O'Brien for the time being, right? That sounds like a New England setup to me. That sounds exactly what New England's like. And then the other side of this is Nick Caserio potentially wanting to get out of his contract in New England. I think it's interesting when you look at the Patriots situation now with Caserio, their college director, Monty Austinfort, I've heard is up after this year too. Those guys, you guys know how this works. You let contracts lapse, right? And so I wonder if we could see a scouting exodus in New England the same way we saw a coaching exodus with all those guys going to Miami with Flores next year. So I think this is fascinating from a couple different perspectives. Like, first, you've got the Houston Texans, which, like, now it seems have empowered Bill O'Brien and probably won't hire a general manager. And on the other side, you got the Patriots, who are sort of looking at this and, like, my God, like, our coaching staff just got gutted, and it could happen in the personnel department next year.
I could understand, on some level, Caserio wanting to pursue a different opportunity. But why would this one be the one? Because it seems like it would be a similar situation to what he is now,
right,
where the head coach controls everything. So why would you go from the Patriots to the Texans?
I think I can answer that. Nick's job in New England is very unique. Like, his job in New England, like, he's a coach. Like, he is not, doesn't dabble in coaching. He, like,
right. He's in the box. He's radioing to McDaniels during the game.
He's in
Josh's
headset.
Yeah.
Like, and I, my understanding is he loves that part of the job, right? So if you're Nick and you're looking at it and you're saying, okay, like I got to be picky where I take my shot, and you love that part of the job, like how many other places are you going to be able to recreate that? Because most places you go, it would be freaking weird to have, like, for the head coach, the offensive coordinator, have the GM in his headset, right? Like Houston's a place where maybe he can recreate the job that he has now. Like, so I think that that's a factor. I think the relationship with O'Brien's a factor. The reason he didn't go to Miami 4 or 5 years ago, they wouldn't let him fire Joe Philbin. So that was so, you know, I get who the coach is important. I think the setup of the job is important too. And so I think for Nick, part of this is like, how can I like this, like Houston's sort of a unique opportunity because there's a guy who has actually had Nick Cassero in his headset before running the show down there. And I think he feels like they can strike a balance from a power perspective because they know each other so well.
I guess where I am failing to sort of see the value in this move is that, you know, O'Brien's what, in his sixth year in Houston? You're not, it's not like he was be going with Josh McDaniels somewhere or, you know, Flores somewhere or whatever the case may be. And you're sort of starting this build from the beginning. O'Brien's in year six. He's been through two GMs. They've been to the playoffs, but have not advanced. Mm-hmm. Have not advanced very far. So, I mean, I don't know that this would necessarily, I don't know that I would force my way out of New England for a similar situation in Houston that you don't know how long that would last. That would be my concern there.
I think the other underlying thing here, and I think that this part of it's interesting too, all those coaches leaving New England last year, like, and all the scouts leaving New England potentially next year, like, and again, you guys know how this works. You have to let your contract lapse. The way it works in the NFL, like the norm, they put an extension in front of you to get you locked up for 2 years. Like with the assistant coaches and scouts, that's generally the way it works. And so a lot of times when scouts get out, it's because they made the decision, I'm betting on myself, I'm going to go into my contract year because I think that there's going to be a better opportunity elsewhere. Joe Douglas did that when he left Baltimore to go to Chicago, right? And so the fact that these guys are letting their contracts lapse, and it was, I'm going to count now, but it was Jerry Schaplinski, and it was Josh Boyer, and it was Chad O'Shea. Brian Flores, they wouldn't have been able to stop, but he was one of the guys that walked too. And then Brendan Daly went to Kansas City.
Right.
I think that there's, like, I think some people, the people in that building, I think, look at being in New England post-Belichick Brady as a tough spot to be in. Like, so I think that this idea that, like, someone wants to be the successor to Bill, I don't know that it really exists. I don't think Josh that way either. Like, because you think about this, if you're succeeding Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, 10-6, that's like a failure, right? Like, do you want to be in that position? I think that's what's so interesting. Why would you want to go to Houston? I think part of the question for these guys is, do I really want to stay in New England? Do I want to be here when Belichick and Brady are gone? And I think for a lot of those guys, the answer is no.
And that's a fair point. That is interesting because it also speaks to what is the lifespan that they expect of Belichick and Brady. Like, how much longer do they expect that partnership? Because I think that's probably something that really no one outside Belichick and Brady right. have a clear idea of. But what are they betting on? What are they putting the tea leaves together? You know, how do they see it unfolding is interesting. And if there are signs like this, then that's notable.
Are you hinting at, like, is there something in the tea leaves that, like, of Brady and, I mean, obviously age is undefeated, do you feel like it's happening?
I don't think anybody knows. Like, I just don't. And Jenny, you've been around a lot. You've been around Bill a bunch. Jenny was the pool reporter. I don't get the sense that Bill is close to the end. Like, I don't get the sense that he's going to be gone in a year. Like, I just think he enjoys the job, and I'd love to hear your input on this because you were around him like in the most intense environment, right? Like, preparing for a Super Bowl. I get the sense he really enjoys the job. I think Brady's going to be gone in a couple of years. Like, I think Brady, you can already see him starting to, like, the fact that he's not there for the off-season program, like, that's him starting, like, that's some, like, real life, like, shifting priorities. So, you know, I think there's going to come a point in a couple of years where he is going to walk away, and age is going to maybe dictate part of that. I don't know. I don't feel like Bill's I feel like Bill could do this for another 5 years, no problem.
I think what you said makes sense. I would never claim to be able to have any insight into, you know, what he's thinking. But I do think that week of the Super Bowl, it was just as intense as you would expect. And he was really enjoying things. And you know, I think he's always that way a little bit. Super Bowl week, right? Just in front of the media, we always see him relaxing and telling stories and things. But I don't know, you just get the sense that they just got the routine down. They figured it out. Like, it's not even like, it's just routine. It's not even stressful, right? You see like new teams in the Super Bowl and it's stressful, all the logistics. Yeah. Like, it is not stressful for the Patriots.
I think so much of it's turnkey for him.
It's so turnkey. Like, he can go to the Super Bowl is turnkey for him, right?
That's the thing, is like, all the things that are hard about setting up a football operation, like, that's all done for him. Like, right. So it's not like he presses a button and it goes. He still has to work hard, but he can go to the Kentucky Derby the weekend after the draft if he wants to. He can spend 6 weeks on Nantucket. He can do he can do a lot of things that he probably wouldn't have been able to do 15 years ago, because he's got the place wired, right? Like, because the place in certain ways runs itself. And so I think that makes it, like, if you still enjoy it and you're not breaking your back doing it anymore, like, maybe there isn't real motivation to stop.
Yeah. I mean, again, I have no idea, but it wouldn't surprise me if he coached for like 10 more years.
It's crazy.
Like, I would not be shocked.
He was the one who like volunteered it. Like, and maybe this was like a shot at Marv Levy back in the day, but he like volunteered it. Like, I'm not going to be Marv Levy coaching into my 70s.
Yeah.
Was he like 3 years away now? Like, 2 or 3 years away?
But you're right. And it also wouldn't shock me if 2 years late, two years from now, he walked away, right? I mean, I don't think anything would shock me, because I don't have any real idea.
The point we're making, like, I don't think anybody in the building knows. So to get back to that, I don't think anybody in the building knows, but I think that that's even more of a motivator, like, hey, while we're still hot, let's take opportunities, right? Like, let's go, like if you're looking for career advancement, let's take advantage of the fact that we've won 3 Super Bowls in 5 years. And if Bill or Brady were to walk away, like, this might not be quite the same, you know? So I just think it's fascinating, because I think these things happen, guys. And to me, it like sort of gives you a window into what you can't see, because they do such a good job of keeping so much under wraps there. Like, I think these sorts of things, again, like we talk about, like, how your actions can sort of tell people what you're really thinking. Like, I think that's another, you know, people's actions here are telling us what's going on there.
And, you know, the one thing with Belichick, you have seen in recent years this greater willingness, I think, to record things for posterity, right? I feel like the legacy has become a record of things. Now, that is interesting, right? Because that would signal, like, let me do these things, you know, before it's really the end. So it's really hard to put the puzzle pieces together. Like, everything, you know, it's hard to read from the outside.
I mean, I always figured, like, you know, it's like when I was covering the team, I always figured, like, he was going to walk away in his 60s and go, like, coach, like, Wesleyan lacrosse or something like that.
Well, that would be interesting.
I didn't think he'd ever quit coaching. Like, I think he'd always want to coach. But I always envisioned, like, okay, like, maybe he, like, takes, like, some toned-down job. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
interesting.
Like, something like that. Like, I think, like it's just, like, sort of made sense in my head.
Yeah.
And, like, maybe this is sort of like a toned down coaching, because he doesn't have to do quite as much.
Jim Vrendis was a chemical engineering professor at Penn State till age 80.
Wow.
Yeah. He just loved it so much. And he still goes to the office every day as a professor emeritus.
Does he cut down his workload or no?
He doesn't teach anymore. So when he retired, he stopped teaching, but he still goes into the office and like continues research. And there like some publications of research that they've done, they've put out in the last couple
of
years.
Which is part of why people who are really good at what they do are good at what they do, because they would be doing it even if they didn't have to.
Totally. Totally. Jim Vrendis is also a goat, so I just figured it was a natural segue.
Dr. V. All right, news item number 4. And this one is just for our friend Connor Orr. At a football camp this weekend, Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger was asked again about the different feeling around the team this spring. Quote, it's been a little crazy the last few years, maybe more so than usual that we're used to dealing with, said Roethlisberger. To get back to quote unquote normalcy is kind of nice. Now, I don't know. Like, I think you're sort of responsible for part of the abnormalcy here. If only there was
someone in the building who could have stopped it, like a guy in the locker room, like the highest paid employee of the team, you know?
Yeah, it's just like it's sort of weird that he keeps talking about it. I don't know. Like, I never want to be the reporter who's sitting and telling guys to shut up, right? Like, I don't want to be that guy, because we want everybody to talk to us, right? Like, we want guys to be honest and everything else. But doesn't there come a point when he just say, like, look, it's in the past. I'm good. We don't need to talk about that anymore.
I got destroyed when I pointed out that through all the Steelers' best runs, right, their Super Bowl runs, Ben was surrounded by extremely vocal and strong leaders, right? Mm-hmm. I think you could say that about the first Super Bowl,
certainly. So it was 06, 08, and 10, right, were the three they made the Super Bowl.
Right. Yep. And in all of those cases, I mean...
05, 08, 10, yeah.
You had guys like Jerome Bettis and Hines Ward and, you know, all the... Troy Polamalu, like these...
Joey Porter.
Well... But like these guys, like people that were known as like these legendary steward, team steward leaders.
Yeah.
And all I did was point out the fact that like these don't really exist anymore. And now we can finally see what things are like with just Ben. And how's it been going so far? The two best generational talents that your team has had in the last 20 years, two of the best skill position players in the NFL, dove off deck and swam to new locations.
Yeah, and you know, there's no acknowledgement of the fact that he himself, I mean, beyond simply this year, he himself has been the cause of many distractions for the Steelers through the years.
His radio show?
Suspension. Well, no, but you know, suspension for the sexual assault allegations, the motorcycle crash. I mean, so it's sort of it feels unfair to be like, oh, this is more distractions than we've had ever, really. And that's not necessarily true. And he's been the cause of distractions. At this point, all of these, I mean, this is probably true of all offseason NFL coverage, but all of these words are meaningless.
Right.
We have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, we just need to see what happens.
Let me ask you this then. Do you think it's possible, and we all know there are contrived like rallying cries out there, right? Do you think it's possible that there's some contrived like F them rallying cry going on inside the building right now?
Yes, absolutely.
Like Le'Veon Bell, F Antonio Brown. Like, do you think that maybe this is that? Like, I don't know. That's the one explanation I can think of why he keeps talking about it.
I mean, I think there is, because there was a round of social media posts that was very coordinated, right?
Right.
That saying Ben is a great leader. Like, several linemen posted that, you know, in the wake of either Bell or Brown's comments, or perhaps both. So, I mean, I do think there is that vibe going in the building, and they'll probably try to use that as a rallying cry. But I don't love that. Like, I feel like the best way to handle it is like we've seen Wentz handle it. Say like, man, a lot of these, I've said this before, but like Wentz was just kind of like, and Peterson was like, you know what? Carson's got something to learn. He's going to learn from this, you know. There was some truth to some of the comments that were made, right? We're going to use this as a growing experience. Like, take it head on, you know? And I mean, I know Ben sort of said, like, I need to be a better leader. I just hope that is a real self-reflection.
I mean, he's 37 years old.
Right, exactly. It's very different from Carson Wentz, who is sort of molding into his role will be on the team.
There's the whole, like, Tiger's not going to change his stripes thing, right? And then there's this, which is like, this isn't a 25-year-old. There's a 37-year-old who's very, I guess, just set in his ways.
It's an old tiger.
An old tiger.
This is going to be so, because it's going to be bad, right? Because here's what's going to happen. I'm gonna put my hands on the crystal ball here and tell you exactly what's going to happen. The Steelers are going to be better than people think they're going to be this year without Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell.
Because remember, they didn't have Bell last year either.
Right.
So it's not like that's a new loss for them.
They didn't have Brown for every game either.
They're going to outplay the Browns, who, you know, I think they're going to finish ahead of the Browns, who everyone thinks is going to come back, and they're going to take this division by storm. They're going to own the AFC. And Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell are not going to put up comparable numbers to what they were at the Steelers. And everyone in Western Pennsylvania is going to be like, see, this is Steeler way, Pittsburgh ball. And, you know.
Pretty good. That was a pretty good accent there.
We're
going to. Thin inner ear or whatever.
Was that like an accurate Yinzer accent?
No, it was pretty good. Yeah. Good job, Connor.
Thank you. You guys are both from Pennsylvania, so I'm going to defer to you.
I'm a little closer to the Yinzer land.
Yeah.
This is exactly what's going to happen, right? Because it's not far-fetched, right? But at the same time, this is how they're all going to mold their universe and keep walling themselves away from the actual problems, right? And it probably will never be fixed in the era where he's under center.
And there's going to be headlines, you know, Ben wins big game, overcomes adversity of offseason.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
We can telegraph
that
right now.
You guys are forecasting that.
God. I mean,
I do agree with you. Like, I think the Steelers are going to be better than people think. Because I do think that the talent there is still fine. Like, I think
and Tomlin's still a good coach.
They're still good players. They're still good coaches.
This is going to be insufferable. This is what we're talking about. It's going to suck. You know,
it's all going to get thrown back in your face. Well, you need to.
It's not going to be thrown back in my face. I mean, you know, I'm just sitting here. I'm a casual observer. But Jenny's right. The redemption, the horrible redemption stories.
He has to come up with a counter strategy.
Holy God!
We need to help him workshop a counter strategy right now to combat all of this.
It's just what happens when anything sucks. You know, you just sit there and for a week you're just like, God, this sucks.
No, you should be proactive. Like, we need to come up with we need to come up with your counter offensive.
Maybe, yeah. I'm not much of a counter-offensive guy. I'm just a let the wave take you.
You're just going to go with the tide.
And this is going to be a tidal wave of suck. Conor Roar's 2019, a tidal wave of suck.
Jenny, that's kind of a defeatist attitude, don't you think?
Defeatist attitude. Well, listen.
She's known me long enough.
I mean, we did have a group chat once entitled "Everything Is Bad." So yeah. I mean, I'm not really sure how right? off-brand this is. I do think Conor brings up a good point. It's like, who are the leaders on that team? And we don't really know the answer to that, right? And whatever you think about Brown and the way he handled his exit, his work ethic, the way that he worked harder than anyone, right? That was in itself leadership. You know, we all hear the story about him staying after practice with the jugs machine, but that was real. I mean, that's how he became the best receiver in the league. So, you know, there are some questions about, like, you know, you have your offensive linemen who are leaders and Cam Hayward, but like,
that's the weird thing. It's like, I think the line, it almost falls on the linemen, doesn't it? Like, Stephon Tuitt, it's Cam Hayward, and then it's like on offense, it's like Pouncey and Villanueva and those guys, right?
Right, and right. I mean, that and a lot of teams, that's true, you know. So it'll be interesting, yeah. Well, you know, look forward to October and reconvening and seeing how things are going with Conor and over there.
Yep. 12 and our official forecast, 12-4 in an upset Conor Roar.
Tidal wave of suck.
12-4. All right. Who wants to take news item number 5?
All right. I'll take it. After a years-long battle with Alzheimer's, Broncos owner Pat Bowlen passed away last week. He was 75 and had left the operation of the team to President Joe Ellis over the last 5 years. The team won 3 Super Bowl championships in his 35 years of ownership.
I don't think I don't think it changes much for the team in the immediate term anyway, just because like this has sort of been their place for the last 5 years. Like they've, you know, been kind of with an absentee ownership situation for the last 5 years. Brittany Bowlen, who's 29, who's apparently brilliant, everybody speaks really highly of her, is the likely next controlling owner of the team and has been like very, very well prepared. Like Notre Dame, Duke MBA, has worked in big business. Like everybody who knows her says she's ready for it, or she's going to be ready for it soon. Bowlen's legacy to me, like I don't even know what the Broncos were before him. You know what I mean? Like they're like, I thought about this the other day. They're really a brand name team now. Like, right? Like they are, I don't know if you consider them like on the level of like the Giants or the Steelers, like flagship franchises, but there's someone like they're not bad very often. When they are bad, it turns around pretty quickly. Like it's been a very, very well-run operation. And I think, you know, maybe the greatest tribute to that was that, like, in the first year of this situation, they won a Super Bowl, right? Like, or the second year of this situation, they won a Super Bowl. So it's so well run that it's sort of, and it hasn't been as good the last couple of years, but it was so well run that a couple of years after he was out of the picture, like, they won a Super Bowl. So I don't know. I just think, like, he leaves a pretty strong legacy. I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah, you're right. It is one of the more prominent names in terms of franchises. I mean, it's a place that you often hear players would want to go there, and you know, so I think that's absolutely true.
Okay, the one thing I wanted to do, because I forgot to put this in the news items, and I absolutely need to get Connor's opinion on this, because I think when we did the podcast last week, I believe it was right before the announcement, right? Like maybe a day or two before the announcement. But the team that will be the Hard Knocks team for 2019, which I think most of us expected could be the case, will be the Oakland Raiders. Connor, it's all yours.
This is like 3 bad categories for me in a row. I will say this. I think someone brought up the point where it's like the he who doth protest too much thing with John Gruden, where he's talking about like, oh, I'm going to hate it. This guy is absolutely going to love Hard Knocks, because what did he do in the 10 years between when he was coaching, right? He invited all his reporters down to the fired football coach's office to watch him watch film and how hard he works and everything like that. This guy gets off on stuff like that, and he's going to love the fact that...
So you think he's going to cooperate?
I think it's going to be more than cooperation. I think it's going to be like executive producer type stuff. Yeah,
it's so interesting too, Jenny, because it's like...
Am I wrong?
You have two guys who are literal. You have two guys who are literally on TV for the last decade,
right? But didn't want cameras in their war room,
right?
So there is sort of this interesting, right?
Yeah, I think that that's the thing, is like everybody assumes. So like my feeling with Hard Knocks is like everybody assumes just because they're great personalities that it's going to be, when there are great personalities in the roster, it's going to be awesome. I think it's more about cooperation than anything else. Like, I think any NFL team, it could be entertaining with any NFL team. Like, I think any NFL team, even the most nondescript teams, there are interesting stories. There, like, you could find a way to make it good. I think it all boils down to cooperation. And so I think a lot of this, like, and we can go through the names, Richie Incognito, Vontaze Burfict, Antonio Brown. There's so many guys there, Bianchus, Mayock, and Gruden that could make this interesting. I think whether or not it is comes down to how much Gruden and Mayock are willing to cooperate.
I think that this is either going to go one of two ways. I think this is going to either be a replay of like every Gruden feature that we've read, like I just alluded to, which is like that I'm in the film room all the time, and living ghost of Al Davis, and like all this stuff.
The opening scene is absolutely going to be him driving in the dark to work.
Right,
book it.
It's either that
or
the complete polar opposite, which is going to be a total acting job, which is going to be him distancing himself from the cameras and making it look like he's not interested.
Which could be the theme of the story. Okay. Like,
it's either going to be one of two things. Yeah.
So you're saying like the theme of the season could be Gruden versus the cameras.
Yeah, and like, you know, like almost
which
like
you
a
think
Texan,
it's going to be an act.
Almost like, yeah. I mean, okay. I don't think it's going to be an act. I know you're not allowed as a. I guess I'm an armchair psychologist. I know we're not allowed to legally analyze public figures that we've never actually treated before, but I think I feel pretty safe locking that one down.
Here's what I'm interested to see. You hear a lot of people saying like, oh, the game has passed Gruden by, or like this generation of athletes has passed him by in the last 10 years. And that is something that would very, if that's true, that is something that would very easily show through. Because if that is the case, he would not necessarily know, right? The things that he's saying are not, you know, ideal for this generation of athletes.
Right.
He's not connecting with
them. So out of touch.
He would not know that those things would come through. So that is, if things go negatively, that is, I think, how they'd go negatively. Or we saw with the Browns, right? I mean, the infamous scene in the meeting room with Hugh Jackson, telling Freddie Kitchens whatever, and that's the kind of scene that can be interpreted one of two ways. I think there's definitely the potential for that, because the way it's set up now is you're not having successful teams on Hard Knocks, right? Mm-hmm. It's very different from when the Jets were on it with Rex and everything was rolling, and you had some built up.
That was coming out of 2009, I believe, right?
Yes, you're coming out of an AFC Championship game year, so you've got this built-up like cachet and, okay, things are going in the right direction, where the Raiders, I think a lot of people are looking at this with suspicion, and so it is possible to me that Gruden is nervous.
I think if he doesn't have a plan, he should be, right? I mean, Hard Knocks is all about the message. There's no reason that a team submits to this without them needing something in return, right?
Right.
The Browns needed something. The Rams needed something. The Texans needed something. The Buccaneers needed something. They all needed something back from HBO. And the Raiders need something back, right? They need to legitimize this operation. Because right now it doesn't look, right now it looks like ridiculous.
It's not only legitimizing, it's also like part of this, at least, selling it to Vegas too, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Like selling club seats, selling suites, selling season tickets, all that stuff. Like, I think that's in play too. Like, how big a part of the season is that? Is the fact that the team's moving in a year?
Good luck, guys. Only 9 years left on that contract. Woohoo! Have fun.
I can't wait. I think Connor's right. I think
41 by the time he's done.
I think
41. God.
Like, thanks for discussing that age that way. I appreciate it. I'm 2 years away from
I'm
going to be 41 in like 18 months.
The other day we were talking about The Bachelorette, and our Kaylin Kaler said to me about Hannah, like, she looks really old. She looks 33. Then there was a pause in the group chat. She goes, oh, 33 isn't old, Jenny. I was like, Kaylin, you cannot save this. So just let's just move on to another topic.
I try to think of that every time I walk into a bar now. Like the way you looked at older people when you were like, you know, 20 in a bar. Like when you're sitting there and like, you're like how pathetic you thought the older guys in the bar were, right?
Yeah.
Like I think of that every time I walk into a bar now is like, all right, is this the right place for me? Like I don't want younger people in here thinking that this guy's a creep, like that sort of thing.
So the other day I went back to do like a class at Syracuse and I was walking around and I was going to buy something from the bookstore and I FaceTimed my wife and I just said, do I still look like I might go here, you know? Because all of a sudden, like, you know, you start interpreting all the looks that you get, yeah. You know, and everyone's like, oh, God, like, what's that guy, you know, where is he? Is this a janitor or something, you know? And she said, no, it definitely don't look like you still go there, so.
Burn.
Yeah, wow. It's tough.
Wow.
Tough getting old.
So your wife is honest with you, too. It's good to hear that.
So Connor will be on Medicare when Gruden's contract lapses.
Just watch that Instagram. Thanks, guys. All right, and we're going to jump right into the six-pack. You guys know how this works. Every week, I put the call for questions out on Twitter. That happens on Tuesday. I pick six. If I pick yours, you get a like. That means I hit that little heart on Twitter, and you get an answer here. Question number one from Brian Rosen. That's at RoBone1999. With all the excitement surrounding the Browns, what is one storyline that you are watching that is not being talked about? I will tell you, Brian, the storyline that I am watching that no one seems to be talking about is what's going to happen on their offensive line. That was a strength of the team a few years ago, and they've lost two very significant players in Joe Thomas last year and Kevin Zeitler this year. And so, to me, so much of what happens with the Browns is going to boil down to managing that problem. I think it could be the difference between 7-9 and 10-6, to be honest with you. You just don't see teams that have major issues up front win very often. And if you want to look at the common thread between the four teams that were alive at the end of last year, the Saints, the Rams, the Chiefs, the Patriots, all of them are heavily invested in their offensive line. They all have very good offensive line coaches, and they all have invested in players in those positions. And so I think that's the one storyline with the Browns that more people need to pay attention to. Kevin Zeitler's gone. Joe Thomas has now been gone for more than a year. They got rid of Desmond Harrison. Left tackle, they've got Greg Robinson, who they've been able to resurrect to some degree after he washed out of the Rams, the former second overall pick, and then Austin Corbett, who was their second round pick, one of their second round picks in 2018. So keep an eye on that offensive line. Question number two, this is from Don Ridenour, at Don Ridenour. Will Cam Newton become a more accurate passer this year? I think the answer is yes, because he was becoming that last year before he got hurt. And people forget how well he played and how good the Panthers offense looked through the first 2 months, and how innovative North Turner and his son Scott were in putting that offense together, and how much they were getting out of Cam Newton, how he became a better passer, how he was able to play point guard a little bit more, and how the skill position talent around him has gotten a little bit better. And so this is health permitting, and everything, of course, is health permitting in the NFL. But health permitting, Cam Newton took a major step forward last year before he got hurt, and there's no reason to believe that he can't maintain that step forward. Now, he's never going to be the most accurate passer in the NFL, but he was way more accurate last year than he had been, and I think there's every reason to believe that he's going to be able to pick up where he left off. Again, one more time, health permitting. Question number three from first of his name. Is that right? He's got all these digits in there. At first of his name, do you think the Daniel Jones reviews are legit, or just teammates being good teammates and coaches being positive about their players? So here's what I think. First of his name, I think that, and Brandon, you're a Giants fan, right? So our producer Brandon, Giants fan, how do you take it? How do you take the Daniel Jones thing?
I'm just taking it day by day. Okay, I don't really have a comment. I'm just letting it all unfold.
I'm going to give you some hope. All right, I'm going to give you some hope. I don't think Pat Shurmur says what he said last week unless Daniel Jones is playing really well, right? If he's not performing well, and remember, it's before pads go on, we don't know anything yet. But I will tell you, a lot of times coaches in these situations are talking through the media to their locker room. And the one thing I know covering the NFL, the locker room knows. And so the reason why a coach would do that, after having said for 6 weeks it's Eli's job, the reason why he would open up a competition because the locker room knows something. And if the locker room knows something, he's obligated to act on it, right? And it's hard to sell every position's open. There's competition at every position if you're closing position competition at the most important position. And so I think you absolutely take what you've heard out of the Giants over the last week at face value. Daniel Jones has got off to a very fast start. I do believe that. I think he's put himself in position to compete for a starting job, just like players at other positions would. And it's impossible to sell. We're competing at every position if you're not doing it at the most important position. Pat Shurmur knows that. I think what he said last week was with a purpose. It doesn't mean that Daniel Jones won't take a step back in August and fall out of the competition altogether. That could happen. Possible. But I think he's built enough momentum now where maybe Shurmur felt obligated to his locker room, to his players, to see who the best quarterback on the team is, which may not have been the plan right away. If he really stumbled around the last 5 or 6 weeks, I don't think that Pat Shurmur says what he said last week. So there's one for you, Brandon.
We'll see how this goes.
All right, question number 4 from Marco. That's at Marky Boy 2305. Do you think the Chiefs are keeping Hill? Because if they cut him, another team will claim him, Reeve, Foster, and Hunt. Shouldn't this practice be stopped by the NFL? Here's what I think it is. All right. When you take a risk on a guy like that, and then you invest time in him, and you invest money in him, and you bring him up, and you go and you take all the PR hits that come with taking a player like that. Like, I think the mentality of a lot of these teams, and I don't think it's necessarily right, is we didn't go through all of that to have somebody else benefit from it. And so I think in a lot of these cases, you see players hang on to, I think this was the case with the Browns and Josh Gordon for a lot of those years, where you say we didn't go through all of that just to have some other team, and some other team that could wind up being our opponent, benefit from this. And so I think that's a big part of any one of these sorts of situations. I think it is a part of the situation with Hunt, and I've said this or with Hill, and I've said this over and over and over again. This is about how good a player he is. If he wasn't a top 5 player on that roster, he would have been gone. You talk about due process, all the rest of it. We've got tons of other examples of players where at the first sign of trouble, the team cut him. And it's the reality in the NFL. I think it's the reality probably in pro sports. I don't know the other ones as well, but the reality is talent affords people second chances. That's the reality in almost any line of work. Talent affords second chances. And in Tyreek Hill's case, it's afforded him a bunch of second chances. Question number 5 from Jamie Ortiz. That's at Jamie Ortiz PR. Will the Texans trade for Caserio this season? If I'm Cal McNair right now, I'm on the horn with the Kraft family, and I am asking them, what draft pick will it take to get Nick Caserio out of there? I do think Nick Caserio is a very good executive. I think Nick Caserio wants to go to Houston. My belief is that the Patriots would at least listen. Here's one reason why. The Patriots have been investigated so many times now for so many different things. I think if anybody's going to get anything out of them, they're going to make it hurt for that team. And I think that's part of what the tampering charge was. Oh, you're going to investigate us in Deflategate? You're going to investigate us in Spygate? Why don't you look into this and this and this too? Okay, why don't you look at what this team did with Nick Caserio? If you're going to investigate us, you got to investigate them too. And so I think part of that is, all right, like, well, if you want to come and get him, then we're going to make it hurt. I don't know the Patriots will let him go, but if I'm Cal McNair, I'm making that call and not just waiting till next year, because I think a good executive is worth a draft pick. Question number 6, Chris Hart, that's at @who_hearted. How many years roughly until the Broncos' ownership situation is settled? Is anyone that close? Chris, because you're asking this question, I'm pretty sure you have some background on it. So I'll just tell you there's the three-man trustee group that is going to make the decision on when one of the family members is ready. Brittany Bolin, again, like we said earlier, is very experienced. I don't know that she's seen as quite ready, but the fact that she's going to be taking an executive role in the team in the fall is significant. And I think that within maybe two years, I think we'll see Brittany Bolin as the primary owner, the controlling owner of the Denver Broncos. I think you'd like to see her sort of grow into that role a little bit. And I think that's what Pat Bowlen wanted, which is why he put this group of trustees in charge. But I think in two or three, maybe, let's say 2021 or 2022, I know I keep pushing it back, 2021 or 2022, we'll see Brittany Bowlen as the controlling owner of the Denver Broncos. And I'll give you guys a bonus question this week. This is from Ed Tavares. That's at E. Tavares1581. Did you end up getting the puzzle piece out from underneath the deck at the Cisco Brewery? We started talking about my kids because it's that dead time of year. We'll finish it on talking about my kids. Ed must have been there the day at Cisco Brewers. I was there. I believe it was over Mother's Day weekend. One of my kids' puzzle pieces fell underneath one like a deck, you know, Brandon, like where you get those little cracks in the deck. And I actually spent like a half hour with a wire hanger trying to pick the puzzle piece out from underneath the deck. And I did not, Ed, I did not wind up getting the puzzle piece out of the deck. But that's just the kind of parent I am, right? You get a participation trophy. I'm going to break it in half. You lose your puzzle piece. I'll go and try to find it for you. So there's some give and take there. Appreciate all you guys coming out. As always, we want your feedback, especially going into the 2019 season with that on the horizon. We got training camp coming up. You can get to me with any suggestions you guys might have for the podcast on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. Always, always, always remember to listen to our other podcast, the Bad Movies Podcast, which Connor's done a great job with, Bad Football Movies Podcast, the Monday Morning Podcast with Gary Grambling and Andy Benoit, and of course, this podcast, the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, Jenny Frentes and Connor Orr. You can get us and all those other podcasts on one feed now, the MMQB Podcast feed. You can get us on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows. Same time next week. We're going to do over-unders next week. We'll see you guys then.